Mornings and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump held a two-hour call with Vladimir Putin of Russia ahead of a conversation with Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. Trump says Zelensky was also on the phone for the call with NATO leaders.
We also spoke to the heads of most of the European nations, and we're trying to get that whole thing wrapped up. What a shame that it ever started in the first place.
Investigators remain on the scene in Palm Springs, California, after what authorities believe to be a car bomb was set off outside an IVF clinic. Our Jonathan Vigliotti is there and has more on the dead bomber.
A law enforcement official tells CBS News that investigators have found bomb-making materials inside the suspect's home in the community of 29 Palms.
The first trucks with aid entered Gaza following nearly 3 months of Israel's complete blockade. Eden Bartal is with the Israeli Foreign Ministry's Director General's office.
The purpose of the aid is to help the population, not to support Hamas.
CBS News Brief. I'm Matt Piper.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
A win for the Brewers.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports.
The Brewers with a 5-2 victory over the Twins, ending Minnesota's 13-game winning streak. Top of the eighth, the Twins' Royce Lewis looked as if he'd hit his second home run of the day. But Jackson Churio, filling in the past week at center field, made the play of the day on FanDuel Wisconsin.
Tying run at the plate in the top of the eighth. Fly ball, left center, Churio back.
Brewer closer Trevor McGill saw Churio's catch from the bullpen.
Dude, I turned around last second. I just saw a glove like peeking over the wall with the ball, and I freaked out. That was badass. You know, him in center field. You know, I'm really liking what I'm seeing from him.
Tonight, the Brewers open another home series against the Orioles. NBA. A report says Giannis Antetokounmpo will meet with the Bucks this week in Milwaukee to review the season and discuss what's next moving forward with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Wherever you are in Wisconsin, there's a free and confidential Aging and Disability Resource Center, ADRC, or Tribal Partner Agency. We're here for older adults, adults with disabilities, and your families. ADRCs are a bridge to support for benefits and financial assistance, transportation, in-home care, and more. Get to know your local ADRC and connect with resources today. Call toll-free 1-844-WIS-ADRC or go to findmyadrc.org. Paid for by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Had an interesting conversation over the weekend. Attended a meeting of moderate Red Hat supporters who were extolling the virtues of a big, beautiful tax bill, and that how Donald Trump was going to cut taxes on working people. How there would be no more taxes on overtime, no more taxes on tips, no more taxes on Social Security. It was going to be a worker's paradise. And to which I questioned, where in the bill are those things? Look, if they're there, great. Maybe great. Or maybe you just don't ever get overtime again. Or, you know, the people who make most tips don't pay taxes anyway, so it's not really a win. But if you think it is, I guess... to which I said, look, you know, the bill is massively redistributive. We're redistributing wealth from working people to rich people. There are more tax cuts for them, for big business. And I said, look, you know, the reality is we're in an era, we're in the second Gilded Age, where wealth is so unevenly distributed that, you know, workers are getting screwed at every turn. And I got pushback from my union friends. And, fortunately, I had just come across an article over at Yahoo News that put a thought in my head, because, you know, we hear the right talk about Marxism, because it was brought up during the conversation. Well, you want equal for everybody. And I said, you know, what's wrong with some bit of equality? What's wrong with having some sort of an egalitarian society where we all live between the curbs. We're not all perfectly equal, but we're in the same arena. And wealth is distributed a little more equitably, like with our grandparents. And I got to say, look, you know, I just read an article and I sent links to them immediately going, there, here's this, to which eyes got really wide. When you realize that the top 1% of people in this country, the top 1%, which are about 340,000 people, they own almost a third of all of our wealth. The country that they say is worth about, according to the Federal Reserve, about a little over $160 trillion. So when people say, well, we're $36 trillion in debt, that's more than the whole country's worth. No, you're wrong. Stop. Worth about $160 trillion. And how is that distributed? How is that wealth distributed across working people? And the reality is if you were to just take that big number, $160.3 trillion, and divide it by the 340 million people, you'd come up with about $475,000 per person, or you know, almost $1 million a couple, nearly $2 million for a family of four. Now you're talking about actual wealth in families. Instead of having it distributed the way it is, where the top 1% owns nearly $50 trillion of those dollars. So when someone says, Rick, you know, we could take all of their wealth and it still wouldn't pay off our debt. Yeah, it would. Absolutely. Because it's almost a third. And when you look at just that top 0.1%, which is about 340,000 people, they own $22 trillion of that 49. That's an enormous number. When you stop and you think about the amount of wealth just in that 1%. And then you go to the next level, the top 10%. They control that next top 10%. They control $58.3 trillion or another third. So you're looking at that top tier right there, two-thirds of the wealth. The people between 50% and 90% of the wealth, they control another 30%, which means there's 2.5% left for the bottom half of the country. If we were to distribute it, yeah, the people at the bottom would do really, really well. The people at the top would be very angry. And nobody's saying that we want perfect equality. But when you have the kind of wealth in the hands of a very few, when we're talking about gutting social services, we're talking about gutting Medicaid, talking about taking food out of the mouths of children. These are working people that I was talking to going, look, what you're being sold is wrong. This country is enormously wealthy. You are struggling not because the wealth isn't there. You're struggling because the handful at the top are greedy and are never going to let it trickle down to you. And in fact, you're in a union hall that's supposed to be, that is fighting for that equality that you're fighting against. It was the weirdest conversation that I've had in a while, where you're in the one place where you're talking about fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, more equality, a more egalitarian society, more justice economically, and yet spewing right-wing Chamber of Commerce corporate talking points. That's the frustration for me. But when you look at the wealth that this country has, it could be distributed in a way that made us all better off. And how was a lot of that wealth gotten? Well, busting unions, offshoring corporations, killing jobs here. What are we going to do about it? Well, my next guest is going to have an idea of what we should be doing, especially with all the tariff talk, especially with China. So when we come back, my good friend Emily de la Bruyere is going to be here to share some thoughts on what the future looks like with U.S.-China relations. And maybe we better start steadying ourselves, resolving ourselves. Maybe we better start steeling up. Quick break. Right back.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, Reuters had an article talking about U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Doug Wickard calling a bunch of civic leaders to Edwards Air Force Base in California to say, hey, you know, China probably going to want to attack Taiwan at some point fairly soon. We might want to think about possibly a plan, an idea, preparing not just the military, but everybody, because it would be ugly. Also in the article, they pointed to a report last year to Congress that said what I've been saying for a long time. The U.S., this is right from the article, the U.S. population was not sufficiently prepared for the disruptions in supplies or services when they did a mock-up. Cyber, you know, like one of those war game kind of things. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. We elected a lunatic as president because the price of eggs was too high. Not because there were no eggs. It was just too high. What's going to happen when there are no eggs? I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, what does this look like? What could it be? What should we be doing? I've asked my China expert, Emily Delabrie, to come talk with us. She is a co-founder over at the Horizon Advisory. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you for having me on.
So walk me through this. I mean, I'm looking at this Brigadier General's comments. I'm looking at him, you know, walk through what we've talked about a number of times over the years, that China's getting a little more muscular. They're spending a lot more money on military and offensive military. This is not good.
Yeah, I mean, one way or another, whether it's China actually using its military and invading Taiwan, or China pursuing aggressive anti-market policies internationally, the U.S.-China competition is going to come to a head. And if that hasn't already happened. And when that does, the strongest tool in the American arsenal is our military. But right now, our military is less and less of a threat to China. And Beijing realized that. As the article said, we're not ready for war. And that's very, very clear.
Yeah, I got a book that was done about my friend Scott Paul over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing, mm-hmm. along with former Governor Tom Ridge, who was head of a Republican head of Homeland Security, the first secretary. They did this lengthy report of a lot of the things over a decade ago that we couldn't make here at home, that we were reliant on China for. And they concluded well over a decade ago, hey, this is bad for us militarily. This is bad for our military. It's bad for national security. It's bad for the country.
I mean, even if you just think about the defense industrial base very specifically, right? We're not making the sophisticated things like the rare earth magnets that you need for military equipment. We're also not making the things like bearings and valves and coatings, anti-corrosion coatings for military equipment that are necessary. Things that we could across the board, but that we don't have the industrial infrastructure, expertise, or capacity to make. And that means that if push comes to shove and China cuts off supply, it's not even like we'll lose in the fight. It's that we just won't fight because we can't.
Well, no, I mean, we'll just call them up and go, hey, you know, I need some stuff because we need to bomb you, and we can't keep this going without you sending us stuff. And I'm sure he would oblige, you know, much like they did. Absolutely. With N95 masks during COVID.
And then that, I think, points to the other thing, too, is it's not just the defense industrial base. And like, if we're in war with China and we can't buy our bombs from China, what are we going to do? It's also that our population more generally and our lives more generally depend on inputs from China. And so even if we were able to separate all of that military industrial base and make that all at home, what happens when our economy doesn't work?
Look, this is what this story talks about as well, that, you know, during that war game thing that they had, the simulation that they did, they said, you know, the population isn't sufficiently prepared for, you know, anything really. And I would argue that, we're not my grandparents' generation. Like I said, you know, we elected Trump because of the price of eggs, not because there weren't eggs there. And it got me, as we said before air, you know, my grandmother, you know, used a pencil to draw a line up the back of her calf so it looked like she was wearing stockings, because you couldn't get nylon or any of that stuff. I can't imagine how we in this society where we are right now would tolerate that kind of that scarcity, that inability to get what we want, when we want, how we want, and quickly for cheap prices. I don't know what we would do.
Exactly, because we're addicted to that immediate gratification. And at the same time, we've never as a country been more dependent than we are today. So it's, you know, the worst of both. It's that we have no toughness and we have no resilience. And that's, I think, a real problem.
Yeah, no, look, I've been saying that, and I've been getting a lot of pushback going, oh, no, you're wrong. You go out there and you meet someone. Individually, fine. I'm talking about as a society, as a whole, as a collective. I think we would lose our ever-loving... Look, we were locked up for a couple weeks during the pandemic, and people were about ready to jump.
And I do think that there is, like... And this is pie in the sky, and how does it happen? But there is a messaging answer in part here. I don't think the population has been sufficiently... informed,
right,
for lack of a better word, about what happens if we don't take the China threat seriously, and what happens if we don't eat costs now for the sake of trying to win in the future. And, you know, that probably makes a big difference if we could do that. Yeah. And that would help across the board too, in terms of making us more resilient as well, but it's not there.
No, I was arguing this back when Obama was president. The idea, as I had a number of people secretly, quietly explain to me, that the TPP really wasn't about trade as much as it was about building alliances to surround China and then pull them into line. And I said, well, had you made that argument, maybe you would have gotten people on board. Still not me, because it was a bad trade deal top to bottom. Yeah. But at least you're preparing people for what ultimately we know is coming.
And like, right now, I mean, first of all, it's been how many years since then? I can't do math, but almost 20. And it's become very normalized that China is our adversary, right? Like, that whole conversation has changed, but it hasn't changed in a way that anyone knows what they're talking about. When they say China is our adversary and that means we're going to have to do X, Y, Z, it's just like, oh, over there somewhere across the world, there's something we need to be worried about, maybe. But we can keep going on in life as normal and markets as normal and military preparation or lack thereof as normal. And we're just all going to think about competing, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out. Look, I'm a kid of the Cold War. I still remember, you know, mutual assured destruction and diving under the desks because nuclear winter was coming, because somehow Catholic school desks stopped nuclear fallout. I'm not sure how, but that's what I was told. I can't imagine, you know, thinking back, you know, to that time, that we would go, yeah, the communism is okay, as long as it's the Chinese and they believe in free markets or some version of capitalist markets or some version of you know, trade. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how we got here while going, yeah, we're going to open our doors to the communist Chinese government.
Because life is too easy in the interim. And we're just so addicted to that ease, I think, is the problem. And so no one's willing to say, oh, wait, if we keep doing this and if we keep waving our arms and saying no problem here with how we're living our lives, then we're going to lose. And it's going to be really, really bad.
So what you're saying then is we need wholesale change, which that's never going to happen. But you're saying life cannot continue as it is, or am I hearing you right, that there has to be some kind of wholesale change?
Yes, and it can't be like the scalpel. We're going to carve out this area of trade and protect this technology, or we're going to stop buying this small thing from them. Like, our whole economic system, industrial system, military system, and therefore social system has to change.
So what you're really talking about is an economic war that eventually, quite frankly, could turn into another Cold War, even if you agree that I kind of do, that we're already there.
Exactly. Well, we need to engage in it now. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a much harder sell than, you know, the price of eggs are too high.
Yeah, but like the alternative future is so bad.
Well, walk me through what you see that being.
I mean, the alternative future is one where we become so dependent on China, as we already are, that when they cross, you know, quote unquote, red lines, we can't do anything about it, right? So we're unable to compete. Meanwhile, China's system is growing and growing and growing. Chinese companies are getting bigger and stronger. They're proliferating internationally. They're pushing our companies back. So suddenly, our economy, our industrial system is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until such point as China pulls out the life support that it's on through connection with China and our economic system falls apart. So, for example, China stops trading with our pharmaceutical companies. We don't have any medical supplies. Oh, whoops, we can't do anything about that because we can't be like, oh, China, you broke the rules. We're going to attack you or fight back because we have no leverage. What that then leads to is a world where our economic system has fallen apart and Chinese companies buy up all our companies. They buy up our farmland because our farms fell apart and China stopped when China stopped buying soybeans from us. And we end up in a world where the U.S. is an economic colony of China. And yes, we have businesses here, but they're subsidiaries of Chinese businesses. And all of their growth is going back to China. All of their actual opportunity is going back to China. And what American people are doing is cleaning data and monitoring drones as they follow smart ag paths in the Midwest. And maybe we're biopharmaceutical subjects for Chinese testing. And there's just no opportunity here. And there's no growth. And China sets the rules and China makes the money.
How come we're not hearing more of this in any other media source? I mean, I'm sure there's something out there that I'm not seeing, but I'm not hearing it laid out in those kind of stark terms anywhere.
I mean, I think that there are two problems. The first is I think it's really, really difficult for most Americans today to imagine a world where we're not in charge and where we don't have the benefits that come from global leadership, including opportunity. Like, that's just an impossibility. So therefore, the scenario is more like, oh, well, we'll have a competitor. We'll have to worry about some things. I think that's one problem. And I think the other problem is that the world where China wins is very likely not one where there's a military conflict. And that's not a framework that is mainstream in how we think about international competition and threats. And therefore, it's not one that's like easy to map out and see the threat of.
So the first thing that I'm thinking now is, you know, our friends around the world, if we still have any, they've got choices to make in this moment, because you've got someone like Trump who is, you know, is literally beating them up as we speak, trying to shake them down, and China, who's probably offering them, you know, Trump's golden toilets. So I guess, what does that look like for the rest of the world if we're not that leader and we don't have that kind of coalition to kind of take all of this on? What does that look like?
I mean, if they end up deciding that the China alternative, or even the like not being on our side alternative, is the better one, it accelerates everything, right? Because China gets more inroads international quicker. It gets more technology more quickly. And we lose on trade relationships that might help us bolster the industrial capacity we need and all the positives we need to stop like the bad alternative future. I think that there could be with the right like negotiation approach, and depending on the leverage our market offers, like a positive route at this point. If our allies and our friends realize that the U.S. market is really strong and hugely appealing, and they're not going to get that for free, and to get that, they need to have hardline policies on China. That's like how we start moving in a not the end of the world.
That makes sense. That's actually smart. And, you know, the last time we spoke, you said, look, you know, we use tariffs on countries that do... give China preferential treatment, use them in that way, as opposed to we're just going to use broad-based tariffs on absolutely everyone, and we'll wheel and deal, and whoever gets to me first gets the, you know, this kind of crazy nonsense that Trump's been known for over his career. That has rarely ever worked, to be honest. I mean, I'm in this moment where I'm reading stories about him wanting to take more direct action in the economy or more direct action in international affairs. And I'm going, isn't this the guy who filed bankruptcy a bunch of times and screwed virtually every contractor he's dealt with? I mean, isn't that guy? And is that going to fly?
And the question is, like, is there a direction, I think? Because, like, tariffs actually are an extraordinary asset for the U.S. because our greatest asset is our market.
Right.
And so if we can say, like, you only get that if why, and if that why is the right thing, which is, like, you join us in the war against China, then tariffs are how we get to the wake-up call.
No, but this is why I'm in favor of them, of the tool being in the box. Like I said, I got a hammer in my toolbox, but I got 100 other tools. You have to have that there, and it has to be useful. But I think he's just, you know, like a kid with a hammer in a glass shop. Not good.
The thing that worries me is the relaxation of China, of tariffs on China, which obviously are a huge, huge cost to the economy. But I think that's the kind of thing we need to keep and to be tough on and not blink on.
Do you have any faith he will? Do you have any faith whatsoever that he's not going to just cut a really bad deal, claim victory and move on? And we're not even just as bad as we were, but actually worse off than we were when he started.
I don't think you can make deals with China.
I think he's going to. I think he is absolutely, without question, going to be Mr. Art of the Bad Deal. He's going to make a bad deal. He's going to come out and say how wonderful he did, and he opened up China, and he's the guy. And ultimately, it's going to be like the last deal he made. Nothing moved forward. Things continued to get worse. But hey, he got his day in the sun.
The thing to do with China is really to pull the maniac move and to say, sorry, I don't care. Like, here's blanket tariffs. I'm going to ignore all the things that you, China, thought were the case about the American system and force you to scramble. And we kind of started in that direction, and it's not that now. Right. And I feel like China's taking a big sigh of relief and saying, okay, they blinked. Like, we do have the leverage we thought we had. This is actually the same scenario as it's been up to this point.
So when this is over, because I have no faith in Trump whatsoever to do the right thing or get a good deal, let alone a bad one, Is there anyone else out there doing this? Are there Democrats who are going, hey, you know, tariffs aren't a horrible thing. We can use them strategically in the fashion that you're talking about. Is there anyone?
I think there have been a handful of Democrats who, I mean, no one has come out pro tariffs. Like, me saying I want these, like, higher tariffs on China, I have no friends out there, like, at all. I thought I had none to begin with. I have even fewer now. Maybe you. Thank you. But there have been a handful of Democrats who have come out in favor. And I mentioned this last time, but Chris DeLuzio, he's said tariffs are a terrible thing. He got panned by the Democratic establishment saying that. And he's not, like, the type of voice that's being elevated in the party, in the Democratic Party. And the voices that are being elevated are the ones that are somehow arguing that free trade means no tariffs, even against China, which is a crazy.
Which is insane.
Yes, precisely. So, like, even if there are voices who are saying that on the other side, they're being silenced, is my fear.
So then this means that we, the American people, have got to be calling for, as I say this all the time, politicians are just tools to be used to get what we want. We just have to know what we want to use the tool properly. So last question I've got, how do we take what you're saying and turn that into some actual direct action?
I mean, I think that it's so frustrating to say, like, well, it goes back to still messaging at this point, because we've been having these conversations for years at this point, and we've been saying that for years at this point. And that it was, like, too late when we first started talking to, like, play the messaging game. But there is part of it of, like, America as a country needs to internalize the risk of China, so that then, instead of saying, oh, stop these tariffs, like, here's the political pressure to stop them, as just happened, we say, no, put them back. You're going to lose. Your approval rating is going to drop if you blink on China.
Yeah. No, I had someone say, oh, tariffs are bad. And I said, well, you know, and it was a big Biden supporter. I go, what about the tariffs Biden put on EVs? 100%. And I said, it should have been more higher than that. You go, well, you can't put 100% tariff on things. I go, yeah, you can. And he did, because you opened up our market to the Chinese EVs. They're done. All of our auto industry is done because they are making them that cheaply. And the Communist Party is subsidizing this stuff that cheaply, and you've got to protect your own industries. That's why I say I'm a protectionist. When I walk out the front door of my house, I turn around, I lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. There's no giant moat around my house, but I do lock the door. And I think we better start thinking about in those terms fairly soon. But Emily, as always, I appreciate the input, the thoughts. Not a rosy picture.
No.
I'm not walking away all smiley, but a little bit better informed, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Emily De La Brea. Again, as always, check out their website, the good work the folks do at Horizon Advisory. We'll get links out on social media. Got to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A wet pattern ahead, increasing clouds tonight, showers possible late, and a low in the low 40s. Scattered showers for tomorrow, high only near 50 and staying windy. Still a few lingering showers Wednesday. A high in the low 50s. Currently 49 degrees.
Breaking sports radio show news coming across the ticker. In a move for the ages, 105.5 WIRI has traded for playmakers. Join us 4 to 5 Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Hit us in the numbers by calling with your sports takes and feelings. We'll have James, Randy, Michael, and Seth bringing you local sports coverage and news that you won't hear anywhere else. Thanks to our friends at Quality Plus Printing and Family Natural Foods. Be heard 4 to 5 every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on 105.5 WIRI's newest roster edition, Playmakers. We speak sports.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently, the National Weather Service, and we talked about this last week, evidently about half of the National Weather Service forecast officers are short about 20% of their employees. Twice of what it was a decade ago. And thank you, Donald Trump, for that. Of the 122 weather offices across the country, 8 of them are missing more than 35% of their staff, including the ones in Arkansas, where they're tornadoes and torrential rain hitting. Yeah, right now, this week. And look, you know, we got really bad rains at my house over the weekend. And you know, I knew they were coming because I got a weather app that said, oh, yeah, thanks to the Weather Service. When that goes away, it'll just be, oh, surprise, look what happened. Yeah, I can't wait. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad it is from Oklahoma, our good friend Sarah Burris. She's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website, coming from the home office in Oklahoma. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how are you?
Or just the home, you know, mom and dad's
homeland.
Home back in Oklahoma. Won't it be great when the Weather Service is done and when those tornadoes come through your backyard, it'll be like, oh, look, a tornado just hit. And you'll have no time to prepare or anything. Won't that be great?
So I've actually written a ton about this because in this area of the country, meteorologists are like gods. You know, like they are people who will save your life. There was a crazy tornado on, was it Thursday or Friday in St. Louis? And there were like 5 people who died in St. Louis. I think that huge outbreak, the last I checked, it was over 20 people who had been killed in that huge multi-state outbreak. But in St. Louis, they had about a 10-minute warning, a 10-minute where the sirens had gone off, but they don't have sirens so spread out around that part of the city that everybody can hear them. And what is so surprising to me is I remember reading in Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation guide to how Trump will take over the world. And it talked about how you don't really need the National Weather Service because you have all of these private companies like AccuView and the weather, you know, weather.com and all of these people who could be doing all of this forecasting. The problem with this is they get their forecasting from the National Weather Service data. So if the National Weather Service is issuing a tornado warning, which means something is on the ground and it's about to, you know, come down on the ground and it's coming for you, they're the ones who are telling you blare the sirens. And so the fact that I think there's I can't remember what the stat was because you were talking about some of the stats, but the chief meteorologist, they are lacking a chief meteorologist in a huge number of National Weather Service offices. And I mean, the other thing that really bothers me is that National Weather Service offices, unlike a lot of other state agencies, have to be open 24 hours, 7 days a week, because it turns out weather happens outside of 9 to 5, right? So a lot of these weather service, particularly like in Kansas, I want to say like Southwest Kansas, they have a National Weather Service office that is now just gone down to 12 hours a day. So what happens if there's a tornado after, you know, 8 o'clock?
Well, leave them. The tornado is supposed to leave a message and it will call back during regular business hours.
There you go. I don't know what kind of cuts have happened in Norman, Oklahoma. I feel like a lot of the time, those National Weather Service offices, if they're the bigger ones, like the hurricane guys or the big tornado offices, they have good relationships with some of the universities. So they're able to kind of shift people over back doing more academic teaching and forecasting and research there. So you can kind of save some of the experts. But I mean, it's scary because it's not just, you know, tornado season where you have insane outbreaks all over the place, but now we're getting into hurricane season and, you know, they're cutting people. You have the southeastern United States with the hurricane forecasters, but there's a satellite office in New Jersey, of all places. And you're like, why would you have a hurricane office in Jersey? It's because if the Florida guys go down, you know, like if you have no power and no access to internet and all of that, then somebody has to step in. And it turns out the guys who are further up north, those are where those hurricane forecasters are.
Yeah, and they've had a hurricane there in the not too recent past.
Well, yeah, when Sandy came up the coast and, like,
you know,
just kept hitting everybody.
But here's the thing. I think we're at a point now in society where instead of having, you know, people who know what they're doing, experts predicting this stuff and, you know, following the data and watching the screens, we would rather have a topless woman riding a banana in a swimming pool making forecasts by throwing darts at things, because that's much more entertaining. And, you know, I'm told about the same level of accuracy. To my red hat friends, kind of like to let me believe same level of accuracy, because that's all it is. It's just throwing darts at a board, right?
I mean, that's the thing that's so weird is you have people who are so anti-science that you're now sort of starting to see it in the Health and Human Services, right? So it's like we're cutting all of the research into different cancers and different, there was like a whole incredible clinical trial they were doing for Alzheimer's. And when you basically end a clinical trial in the middle of it, that means they have to start everything all over again. So a lot of these programs are going to end up, They'll get picked back up when Donald Trump is no longer there, if we survive Donald Trump. But it means that all of those will now cost extra because they'll have to start over again. So this money that they say that they're saving, it's going to end up costing us more in the long run.
Yeah, it's like that old commercial, pay me now or pay me later.
Yeah, and that's been kind of this thing that I keep hearing. It's like, okay, you're gonna kill people. You now don't, now they don't want to give FEMA to a bunch of states. Like even Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas, when they had huge tornadoes move through a couple weeks ago, they needed, you know, emergency funding, and Trump turned them down. And you're like, guys, if you're not even helping your friends out, like what's California going to do when, you know, Los Angeles burns to the ground? So the whole thing has just been, that piece of it is not making enough news, but it's something that obviously, because I'm a big weather nerd, you know, I'm watching constantly.
But it's freedom, Sarah. It's freedom. You have the freedom to enjoy the weather as it happens.
Really?
Not to prepare for it. Or, you know, like a Boy Scout, always carry an umbrella with you. But, you know, this isn't just the Weather Service. It's across our government. You know, I look at what's going on with air travel. Since you were talking about air travel, popped into my head, I don't know that this now's the right time to be flying, given that there's a glitchy air traffic control system, given the fact that there's people leaving in droves because hostile work environment. I don't know. So any air travel disruption stories you got for us?
So I swear to you, if my little cousin Sadie hadn't graduated from high school, I would not have come flown home, because already DCA has its own issues, right? Like we had the crash, and now, and there's been like other incidents with the helicopters, and there was a plane wings that clipped each other. I mean, it's a thing. So Friday, I try to fly out Friday. And we're on the tarmac. We've pushed back from the gate, and there's like 20 planes lined up, and we're not moving for over an hour. And it turns out it's because of an air traffic control issue. And then I want to say maybe 30 minutes later, they shut down the whole airport because weather was moving through, and they had to move all of the planes into a, you know, staging position to handle the torrential downpour and insane hurricane force winds that blew through. And I'm on this plane, and it's like, I mean, I've never been on a plane like that where it felt like a boat. It was scary. And I want to say I was probably 6 hours late getting home. And then I had to, of course, get up at 8 o'clock the next day to go to this graduation. I was like, God help me. So, I mean, and my best friend flew in from Denver, was at the airport the day that that all of a sudden their air traffic became weren't able to connect with anybody. She was like, I had no idea any of it was going on. My plane took off on time and I was okay. But it wasn't until she landed that her mother was like, I didn't want to tell you while you were on the plane, but let me tell you what happened to Denver while you were there.
It's amazing how it's amazing how none of this stuff came to light until, you know, Elon and the Doge ferrets and Trump, and, you know, firing people and saving us money, you know, saving us $2 trillion, right? Did we save the $2 trillion?
Right. Like, that's the thing, is he's like, you know, in November and October, November, saying, oh, we're going to save $2 trillion. Then in December, he goes, well, if we shoot for $2 trillion, then we'll definitely save $1 trillion. And then what was it? A couple of weeks ago, he said, well, I can guarantee you that we are going to save $156 billion, something like that, right, in fiscal year.
So in actual dollars and cents spent, we're going to probably spend an extra $300 billion. Because to your point, you know, that penny wise, pound foolish agenda that they've going on, as we're killing things off, it's going to cost us much more to restart them and get them back up and running after they've boogered all this up.
And that's the thing a lot of members of Congress will talk about, where they're like, look, I think everybody understands that there needs to be a shift in government with how we're funding things and how we staff things to take into account a much more like modern system. And maybe some areas of the government need more people. Some areas need fewer people. Yeah,
that's any large organization.
Right. So I think everybody sort of agrees, like, yeah, of course we want to make some cuts here and there, but they've just made it so willy-nilly across the board that it doesn't make any sense. And so you're just screwing everything up. But it's this, that's the sort of mentality that I feel like came out of Silicon Valley, of let's just break everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's this idea of, oh, we can break stuff because then we can fix it. And it's like, you can't do that with government, because it turns out you need government to handle all of this stuff, like planes in the air.
It's the backstop for society. But here's the thing, and this is where Democrats need to take this messaging. Republicans promised you they were cutting $2 trillion worth of waste, fraud, and abuse. They went in and they got their chainsaw out. And Doge Boy and the ferrets went into every agency with a fine-tooth comb, stole all your data. They've collected a lot. And all they came up with was a small portion. And even that, I'm going to question even that amount. So for me, I got to be honest, I'm looking at this going, maybe government's even more efficient than I thought they were when you want to go in and slash and burn, and that's the best you can come up with.
And that's a thing that has been interesting too, is you've seen some of the secretaries who are fighting back. Kash Patel was just pissed as hell because they were cutting his budget, and he goes into Congress and asks for more money. And you just want to laugh because you think about all these Trump people being like, this is too expensive and we don't need all these people. And then it turns out when they actually get there, they're like, oh, whoops.
And the weird thing is you know, I had nothing but low hopes for Kash Patel. But the fact that he's actually trying to figure out how to run the agency instead of just tanking it, I don't know. It speaks a little bit for him. But since you brought him up, you know, all these conspiracy theories out there that, you know, Hillary Clinton got her wetsuit on and hung Jeffrey Epstein. Thoughts?
That has been crazy to watch because it's like all of a sudden they're like, oh, we're going to figure out all of these conspiracy theories. We're going to tell you the truth about what happened. And then it turns out the government really wasn't lying to you the whole time. And so, I think that's the big thing, right? Is every time I think about, you know, UFOs and aliens and stuff like that, I'm always like, there is no way that this government is capable of keeping something like that.
Nope. And it's the reason secret. I'm not one of the 9/11 conspiracy folks. You know, building number 7 is a question, and it's a big question, and it leaves a lot of room for conspiracy. But the fact that nobody has come out and said, yeah, I did it, or I was part of it, or there was any of that stuff, nothing.
No deathbed confessions, like none of that. And I mean, I think that is the best way that you know that there isn't anything there because nobody's trying to make a book deal off of it.
So I guess the question I have on the Kash Patel thing, will the faithful believe it?
You know, that's a good question.
And will the faithful turn on them for not confirming what they already have all believed and what people like them have told the supporters? So, thoughts?
Yeah. See, if it was anybody else, then there'd be a part of me being like, nah, they're not going to believe him. But with Kash Patel, you know, I mean, he has been an orchestrator of a lot of the conspiracy theories. He's been a spreader, a super spreader of conspiracy theories. So I really wonder if there is a way for people like him to fall out with the nutters.
No, because I'm going, I'm thinking of my red hat friends who are going, no, I don't believe it. He must have got, when he went to DC, they got him. You know, they bought him, or, you know, maybe they're threatening his children, but he can't be telling the truth because I believe that Hillary got her wetsuit on and broke into that prison and killed Jeffrey Epstein.
That just blows my mind. But, you know, I think a part of people who just want to believe their own reality. Yeah. And I get it. Like, I would love to spend my entire life believing that everything is awesome and, you know, everybody's going to be okay in the end. And, you know, but I am smart enough to actually pay attention and know what isn't awesome.
I got to get your thoughts on Trump and groceries. What's the fascination with the word grocery?
That is a brilliant question. It's an important question because that is the question that it seems to be sparking questions about either his sanity or his cognition or whatever. This dude has been fascinated with this term, not the actual idea of groceries, right? But he started talking about, you know, it's an old fashioned term. People used to use this all the time. And I guess what it means is a bag of food, a bag of stuff that you get. And just the way that he talks about it and the way that he was in the Middle East. He did a big tour in the Middle East last week, and he's in the UAE and starts talking about groceries and this old fashioned word. He starts bringing it back again, and he's like, nobody was talking about groceries until I was talking about groceries. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure every week I have a conversation about groceries
in the grocery store where I get my groceries at the grocery store. Yeah.
Right. But the conversation that has happened because of that is kind of going back to that George H.W. Bush video of like, when was the last time Trump was actually in a grocery store?
I would say never.
Like, has he ever purchased his own Diet Coke? Has he ever, like,
Has he ever
Red Hats
gone through a self-checkout?
No, never, know? Never. And the Red Hats are okay with that because, you know, he's up there. That's the reason they like him, that he doesn't have to do those mundane things like they have to do, like go through the self-checkout and deal with the snotty overseer who refuses to do it. I'm sorry. That's a personal thing. I don't like doing the self-checkout, and I'll be honest, I've turned kind of a curmudgeon.
That's taking away somebody's job.
Yeah, I've turned kind of into a curmudgeon over this, and I'm like, no, I don't want to do this job because, one, if I do it wrong, I could go to jail. If an employee does it, they're just a bad employee. Maybe they get fired. I'm not going to jail because I didn't scan the box of Triscuits or whatever right or whatever. And I don't do it. I refuse to do it. So the one, you know, recently they said, well, you have to. And I just left the cart of groceries there. I said, well, I now know what you're doing. You're going to put all this stuff back.
Good.
Because I'm not going to do it. I refuse to do it.
So in Washington, a lot of the grocery store employees are UFCW members. So making sure that I am supportive of their jobs has been something that's been important to me since I moved there. And so, you know.
When did I start working for the grocery store? Look, am I going to have to come in early next time to put the groceries on the shelves that I then pick up? You know, it started with the carts. You know, you got to take your carts back. No, there used to be people who went out and got the carts. That was their job. And for most of those people who did it, it was the best job they could get because that's where their intellectual and their ability put them. But they had a self-respecting job. They had a reason to get up in the morning. And we took that away. And yeah, never mind. Finally, I got to get your thoughts. We've gone way too long, but I got to get your thoughts on Biden and the big news of the prostate cancer.
That breaks my heart. I had heard the prostate cancer news first before I had heard how bad it was. So immediately I thought, because my grandfather had had prostate cancer and it was very slow growing and it was fine and he survived it and everything was great. And so in my mind, I was just thinking, oh, this is fine. Prostate cancer is one of those slow growing cancers. He could probably live with it for another 10 years. And then they said that it was in his bones. And that hit me pretty hard because, you know, he was a very good president to many of us. So that knocked me down. That threw me for a loop.
Our thoughts go out to the Biden family and everyone around them. And it's sad news. But Sarah, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks. Everybody have a safe week in the crazy weather that's coming.
There you go. If you know about it, if you're in one of those places that has a weather service, I hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day that black author and Marxist theorist C.L.R. James passed away. James was born in Trinidad, at the time a Caribbean colony that was part of the British Empire. His father was a school teacher. James became a leading intellectual on the subject of black liberation. His most famous work, The Black Jacobins, tells the story of the 1791 Haitian Revolution, when enslaved black Haitians successfully overthrew French colonial rule. James was a frequent contributor to Labor Action, a Marxist journal produced in New York from 1940 to 1958. He wrote about the struggles of black workers. He often penned fiery language. For example, in 1941, James wrote an article imploring black workers not to cross the picket line during a strike against the Ford Motor Company in Detroit. Ford had a reputation of hiring black workers at a time when many employers discriminated in their employment practices. But James warned his readers that the Ford company was no friend to the worker and that the company was attempting to use race to keep its workforce divided. James wrote, quote, "Ford is one of the most dangerous enemies of labor who exist in this country. This enemy of society has been laying a train of race hatred in Detroit and is now about to touch it off. The organized working class movement and the Negroes will have to fight hard and long to check and frustrate and defeat this sinister plot. This will be no easy fight. In other articles, James also used his pen to call out labor unions for not including black workers and to call for the unification of black and white workers in their struggle. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I know I sound curmudgeon-y, and I hate that. But when you're talking about the self-checkout stuff, I'm just not there yet. Now, my kids get it. They're like, you know, we don't like it either, but it's just everybody does it. And in fact, you know, I guess the great thing about being in the situation I'm in is a lot of times I'll go through the checkout line where there's someone just standing there because everyone else has already been conditioned to go and do it themselves. And for me, I think about the jobs of, you know, my grandmother worked as a cashier for years. She was head cashier for a number of years in a union facility that paid good wages, had health care benefits, retirement. She collected a pension until the day she died. I see it as a way to make a living. And by me going in there and doing it potentially badly, one, there's no upside for me. You know, there's no money to be saved in it. And two, you're costing somebody their job. Now, what's interesting is the person who's the eyes, you know, the ones watching everybody looking for that cheater, they don't quite get that there should be four of them standing there instead of just them. And that they didn't get a raise either. Someone's pocketing that money and it's not them and it's not me. So for me, I prefer to make sure that those jobs are available for people just starting out. We hear a lot of people going, oh, we can't raise wages for, you know, fast food restaurants because that's where kids... Well, you know what? My wife, in fact, one of her first jobs was working as a checkout person. So for me, it's just simple. I know I'm going to get a lot of angry emails. It's just technology. You're afraid. Nope, not afraid of technology. Know how to use it. But I think we should use it sparingly. Just my thoughts. Finally, I want to get into the little back and forth between... Bruce Springsteen, whom I love, and Donald Trump, which, again, when the president, so presidential, most presidential ever, goes after the boss, it's kind of funny. Because, as you know, Springsteen was overseas and went through a very long reality that there are rich people in this country who are taking great joy and taking food out of the mouths of children, that we're crushing dissent, getting rid of due process, all of the things that the boss talked about. Got under the skin of Trump. And he went to where? Well, the Truth Social, to rage. To where he said, I see that highly overrated Bruce Springsteen goes to a foreign country to speak badly about the president of the United States. Not me, but the president of the United States. Never liked him, never liked his music or his radical left politics. And importantly, he's not a talented guy, just a pushy, obnoxious jerk who fervently supported crooked Joe Biden, a mentally incompetent fool, and our worst ever president, capital letters, who came close to destroying our country. If I wasn't elected, it would have been gone by now. Sleepy Joe didn't have a clue as to what he was doing, but Bruce Springsteen is dumb as a rock and couldn't see what was going on. Or could he? Which is even worse, this dried out prune of a rocker, his skin is all atrophied, ought to keep his mouth shut until he gets back into the country. That's just standard fare. Then we'll see how it goes for him. Now, is that a veiled threat? We'll see how it goes. Is that a veiled threat? I think it is. But that is what the president of the United States took time out of his day to write. An attack in every way with the same kind of childish playground language that we've come to expect from our marmalade Mussolini. I don't know where to go with that other than we're in a sad moment. And I agree with the boss. I hope he keeps doing what he's doing. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Matt Piper. The Supreme Court allows the Trump administration to cancel protected status for Venezuelans. That could clear the way for 350,000 of them to get deported. CBS's Christopher Cruz.
Ending temporary protected status doesn't mean the government can immediately begin deportations. The administration told the justices that people might have other legal options to try to remain in the country. And it said the decision to terminate TPS is not equivalent to a final removal order.
President Trump says after a two-hour phone call, ceasefire negotiations between Russia and Ukraine will begin immediately.
President Trump held a lengthy phone call with the Russian leader.
We just spent 2.5 hours talking to Vladimir Putin, and I think some progress has been made.
He said he also spoke today with Ukrainian President Zelensky and other European leaders.
Trying to get that whole thing wrapped up.
But while Mr. Trump was optimistic,